This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3076 for Monday the 18th of May 2020. Today's show is entitled Keep Calm and Varian. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 59 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is a COVID-19 lockdown chat from Scotland.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello, Hacker Public Radio people. I'm here to talk to my good friend Dave Morris. And we don't really have a very firm agenda ahead of us, but we are just going to talk about what life is like under these strange COVID-19 lockdown conditions. So, how are you doing, Dave? You okay?
I'm good. Yeah, it's a good idea, actually. I've been enjoying the other lockdown series that Tad Sarah has been organising on HPR, and there's a similar sort of idea, but it's just something rather nice, you know, especially when you're spending a goodly proportion of your day isolated. Various degrees of isolation, I suppose, but it's just nice to hear some people having a chat, I think.
Yes, I thought that too. And when he suggested it in whichever medium he suggested, I forget which, it was either in Riot Matrix thing or in the mailing list, wherever it was, I immediately said, yes, that's a great idea, I'll join. And that was several weeks ago, maybe as much as 4 weeks ago, and I have not joined once because, unfortunately, it's just a time of day when I'm busy. I'm almost always busy with food preparations or something like that. But I have listened to a few, and I have enjoyed the chat and hearing how other people are coping.
Yes, I've enjoyed listening to them. I also thought it would be good to join, but just haven't managed to coordinate things. It's just the time difference. But since we're both in Scotland, then there's no significant time difference here, none at all even.
No, there's not. Although one interesting thing I always think about Scotland that a lot of people don't appreciate it is that I can't think of many other places in the world where an accent will change so fast going 45 miles between Edinburgh and Glasgow, to the point where a broad Glaswegian accent could be unintelligible to some people in Edinburgh.
I think that's probably true, yeah. I was quite surprised when I first came to Edinburgh, because there's quite a lot of people who speak with a sort of Englishish type of accent with a slight Scottish twang to it. But once I'd moved out to live in the outskirts of Edinburgh, wow, there's a big difference. There's lots of people say Ken a lot of the time, and that took me a while to work out why. Well, it's just an Edinburgh way, and all sorts of strange expressions and stuff. Do they say, yeah. just on that subject, and I don't want to wander off into random stuff, but did they say butcher meat in Glasgow?
Butcher meat? I think so.
Is that a general Scottish term? To me,
what do you think it means?
I think it means fresh meat as opposed to like sort of cooked sliced meat or something, butcher meat.
Possibly. Actually, it's one of these things where I've never really registered. If somebody said butcher meat, I would just take that as meaning meat that came from the butchers other than the supermarket. So I don't know. But I tell you the one thing, actually, that I did discover this week, that we have this fish van that comes around. And what the fish van is it's a van that has lots of fish in it and other things like eggs, etc. But the thing is, it doesn't come from around here. It comes from the east coast of Scotland, not quite where you are, but a little bit further north, Fife, a place called Pittenweem, which I think would probably mean something to you, but maybe not to many of our listeners.
The fishing is from
nearby,
isn't it?
Yeah, it still is. That's where the fish comes from, and Anstruther, which is nearby in the Fife, in east coast of Scotland.
Very pretty places if you're ever in this part of Scotland.
Yes, indeed, yeah, no, definitely a place to visit when this lockdown is over. But anyway, so this fish van comes around and it toots its horn, and then there's a lot of old folk who live around here and they come out all the time. Now, I don't usually bother with the fish van, but I have started bothering now because I'm trying to go to the shops less, and if the shop is coming to me, and as I've discovered, it sells lots of things that I can't actually get in real shops, and it's quite fresh, a delicious fish, I'll go out there. But my son asked me, I said to him, any requests from the fish van? He went, oh, crab, I like crab. I went, you know, they might have crab, actually, freshly caught crab. You know, again, it's something you might not find all that easily in the shops, in the supermarket. So I went out to the fish van, I asked the guy, I said, do you have any crab? And he went, no, but I have got crab meat. And I went, oh, well, yeah, I wasn't really wanting the shells or the legs. I didn't say this to him, but, you know, I was a bit taken aback. You know, have you got any crab? No, but I have got crab meat. I went, right, okay, well, I'll take the crab meat then. Now, Dave, do you know why he said that? Because I didn't.
I don't know, because I come from Norfolk, where crabs are very, very common along the coast, and you get they call a dressed crab, which is the crab meat in the shell. But were they crab sticks, by any chance?
Well, you're close. I know, I thought the same thing as you, that he was saying it's not dressed crab, it's just the raw, it's not raw. Well, maybe it was raw, actually. I had to check when I got home. It turns out crab meat is not made from crab at all. crab meat is made from bits of leftover fish that are pressed and reshaped and put together and sold to make a much cheaper version of crab that tastes a bit like crab but isn't crab.
Wow.
hence why I asked him, have you got any crab? And he said, no, but I have got crab meat. Expecting me to know what that meant.
Yes. There's a secret message in there somewhere, isn't there? Do you get actual sort of sticks with one side has got a pinkish colour to it and the rest is white? Does it look like that?
No, this came in a little tub, but it's the same idea. Crab sticks, I had discovered, are made from crab meat and are very often nothing to do with crabs as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great. I've never really been into them, to be honest, because like I say, in Norfolk, there's a place by the sea called Cromer, which is famous for its crabs. Whether it is still now, I don't know, because maybe there's not many there anymore. But there used to be crab shops galore there, you know, and you could get fresh crab, a live one if you wanted, if you fancied the fight, or you could get a dressed crab and all that. Yeah, it was a common thing to go there as a kid and buy a dressed crab when I was a kid and bring that home for Sunday tea.
Yeah, Cromer. Yes, I do know of Cromer. Whereabouts is that? Norfolk in the east?
Yeah.
So it's sort of
north. Yeah. It's sort of, you know, Norfolk is a bulge out the side of the UK from the Wash downwards, from Lincolnshire downwards, and it's in the more northern curvy bit up there, near the top there. It's a great place. It's quite an attractive place.
Yeah, I went to Norfolk last year, but we didn't go to Cromer, but that wasn't far away. So basically, for people who are not familiar with geography, you come out of London and you basically drive north and a bit east until you reach the sea. That's roughly how you get to Cromer.
True. It's a long drive. People who visit the UK are always amazed how short the distances are, but how long the drives are.
Yeah.
It can be a pain to get to somewhere like that from London.
That's true, yeah. So you zip up the motorway, the M11 to Cambridge, and then it slows down quite considerably after you get into the Broad, well, not the Broads, but the Fens, and then the Broads, I suppose, yeah.
You find yourself in a sort of what's the word? A convoy, that's the word, behind a tractor. You know, a tractor chugging along, and you can't get past it because the roads are narrow, and there you are, you're stuck.
Yes, a very unwilling convoy, yes.
Indeed.
Yeah. So how have you, my first question is, have you been out, or are you staying pretty much in the house?
Well, from March, I decided to keep hidden from about the 13th, 14th of March, when things were just starting to get nasty, but before there was an official lockdown type thing. And so from then till early April, I've pretty much kept in the house, not gone out at all, except after that I decided, well, especially since the weather's getting better, I'm going to go out for a walk as often as I can, you know, once a day or something like that. But otherwise, that's it. You know, I'm not going to, not shopping or going anywhere other than walking the streets or staying in the house.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with it?
Well, I've not that different, to be honest. I suppose the main difference is that at the beginning of it, my kids were still at school. Sorry, the reason I'm laughing is because I got a fright there because my big new PC with three fans in the front suddenly burst into life unexpectedly because I rested my foot in the power button by mistake.
Oh, no. Oh dear.
Because my old PC, which used to sit there, the power button was on the front, but this one, I don't know why, but they put the power button on the top. So, a bit annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway. Sorry, totally. Yeah, so at the beginning, my children were at school, and I thought here in the UK that we were a bit slow to lock down, to be honest. I was thinking, and I wasn't really very impressed with the advice that the schools are not a significant spreading factor in the disease. I just thought, look, we don't really understand much about this thing that's coming. You can see it coming. You can see that, yeah, we weren't in Italy's position. This is back in March, like you were talking about. We're not in Italy's position, but we are going to be in just 2 weeks, really, 3 weeks, possibly, if we start to get a finger out. And I think we just batten down the hatches and, you know, and then we can decide, once we know a bit more about it, we can decide how to, you know, open things back up again. So, that was my big worry, actually, at the beginning, was that the children would bring it back. Now, for most people, I have to say, I wasn't that worried. For most people, I'm in my mid to late 40s. Most people my age and younger, the chances of it becoming serious are maybe a few percent of cases. And the chances of actually dying of it are, I would say, well under 1%. Even back then, I think that was what you could fairly confidently predict. And if anything, they were upper estimates because we didn't know the true number of cases at that time, and we still don't. So, but anyway, I thought, let's not take any chances because, you know, we just need to stop this thing overwhelming the health system, which is the reason why we eventually did lockdown. So once the children were at home, then the only other way really I felt that we could get it was out when we're out shopping. So I do that now once a week. I respect social distancing, and I can't wear a face mask because I've tried, but then I go blind because all the face masks I've tried, my glasses steam up very easily because
I've still got some face masks of the sort that you used to buy if you were doing woodwork and that type of thing, you know, that sort of I think it's not as fancy as an N95 mask, but it's a full mouth and nose type thing, and it's similar in shape but not quite as effective. I can't wear that these days very very long because of exactly what you say, your breath goes up the top and steams up your glasses. So
I've had lots of good suggestions. Now I examine the face mask I've got, which is, like you say, a DIY one. It's not really meant for this purpose. But the way I understand it, what we're doing is when we put the face mask on, is if we're a carrier of the disease, we will protect other people from us more than protect ourselves. Maybe there's some protection that we get, but it has got these flaps that go above your nose, and if you get them just in the right position, it directs the exhaled breath, which contains all the moisture and that mists up your glasses. It does direct that downwards and stops it getting onto my glasses. So it does work. Trouble is, if I turn my head or I move it in any way, it shifts and then it's not in the right position anymore. So I could be halfway through the shop and suddenly it just, you know, it dislodges, and then I've gone blind, and then I can't, you know, I mean, to the extent where I could really can't see if there's somebody else in the aisle, you know, just a few meters away from me. That's so cool. Yeah, so I tried a scarf, and I've tried various other these bands that you get, these, what do you call them, a buff, somebody called them. I've experimented, and yeah, none of them really seem to get away from my problem with my glasses. I don't, maybe it's my glasses, they do have a special anti-reflective coating, which the optician once said was more prone to misting up than normal glasses. Maybe that's it, I don't know.
Yeah, I think mine might have the same. I found if I perch them under my nose, it helps a little bit. But it depends on whether you can get away with that or not.
Yeah, I'm over 14 diopters in both eyes. So if I put them into my nose, I might as well. I'm even just as blind, to be perfectly honest.
No, fair enough.
Yeah, but I haven't.
The mask thing is a problem, isn't it? Even if you could, I mean, you wouldn't want to be going around in the full N95 mask anyway. From what I've heard, they're pretty unpleasant things to wear for a long time, because they tend to get really wet and nasty after a while.
So oh, really?
Really sorry for the medics who have to wear them. Yeah, I think they get, because they take all the moisture out of your breath. So they're going to get pretty damp on the inside and stuff. And you also see people with all these marks around the face where these things are sort of quite hard, pressed hard against the face. So there's that as well.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. Take my hat off to all those who are fighting this in the front line, in the hospitals, and not just the doctors and the nurses, but all the other people who have to keep the hospitals clean and take patients to and from appointments. And you know, I mean, it's just, I stop at the bin men and shop workers, all who are taking greater risks than certainly I am. There's occasion moments when I feel guilty about how comfy this quarantine period is for me. You know, it's the only thing I can really complain about, and I'm not going to complain about it, is the task of trying to educate my children at home with the schools closed. But yeah, that's a very, very, very minor complaint compared to what these other people have to face.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of people in risky positions, for sure. All these guys delivering stuff from the supermarket, man, beautiful, because they're so busy around these parts. You're not using one of those, I take it?
No, I took the, I mean, I haven't, I used to years ago, in fact, actually from the, I think I took part in one of the first trials of that in the UK, which was in the late 90s started. And it was Waitrose at work when I lived down in Milton Keynes. Mm-hmm. And I worked in the Open University car park. Sorry, I worked in Open University and in its car park, which was huge. It's a huge place, actually, the Open University. This Waitrose van would come, and I'd ordered all my stuff online on the website. And then you would just transfer it from the van into the boot of your car and then drive home with your shopping, which was really convenient, you know?
That's cool.
So I used to do it back then, but since in my current house, since I've come back to Glasgow, basically, the shops are so convenient that I just walk to them. And I still do, actually. Even my weekly shop is done on foot. And it also makes up for the fact that I'm not going to the gym anymore, because carrying my weekly shopping back from the shops is a bit of a gym workout in itself.
That's very good, actually. That works out quite well, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah. It's not like that in Edinburgh. There's depends obviously where you are in relation to sort of the centres of I guess old villages and that type of thing. I live in an area that was a village years ago and then absorbed into Edinburgh. But a lot of the shops that were here when I first came to Edinburgh in 1981 or thereabouts, they've all gone pretty much. There's just a co-op, and that's pretty much all there is in the locality. So that's, you know, it's supermarkets or nothing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm spoilt for choice here. I live in a fairly affluent suburb of Glasgow, and so where I live, I have within 5 minutes, I've got a Sainsbury's, a Co-op, and a small Marks and Spencers in a garage, which has actually quite a lot of stuff. And then if I walk another few minutes, I get to a big Asda supermarket. And if I walk another few minutes, I'll get to a bigger Marks and Spencers and lots of butchers and stuff. So it's just, I'm spoiled for choice from here. So that's why I don't use the car. Uh-huh. I confess, I used the car the other day for two reasons. One, because I needed to get so much shopping, some heavy stuff like liquids, like milk and stuff, that I didn't think I could carry it all back. And two, because I was getting concerned that the car battery would go flat because it's been used so little, that I decided to take it out for not a long drive, but just for a 5-10 mile drive, just to keep that battery charged, which I wouldn't ordinarily do. But I felt like, well, sooner or later, its battery is going to go flat. It will do. It's used so little.
Well, that's a really good point, actually. My car sat here in the driveway. It did get used on Monday. It got used on Monday. They had a medical appointment, which they're still honouring if they're sort of long-term things. And so I drove, and I was thinking, will it start? So it's probably a good idea, actually. It'd be a way of getting away from being so stir-crazy in the house as well.
Yes, and it's not breaking the lockdown in itself, because if you keep the windows up and you're driving around, not great for the environment, but everyone's driving an awful lot less than used to, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. You can walk in the streets here. When I go out for a walk, if somebody comes the opposite direction along the pavement, then the convention seems to be you step out in the road and walk in the centre of the road or something, or cross over to the other side, but there's probably somebody over there. So there's a moderate number of people out doing the exercise.
And of course, if you don't want to cross the road, you could always just start coughing uncontrollably. That would get them across the road quick smart.
I did notice that if you're old and creaky and, it's going to take me ages to cross that road, people swerve around you anyway, so...
Yeah, well, I take that, exactly that attitude is, if I see somebody that is less nimble than me, then I'll get out their way. I think that's the etiquette. And to be... just for clarity, I've never done that coughing thing. I was just joking.
You probably get shot for that sort of thing before long, I don't know. It's a strange dance one has to go through and walking along.
Yeah. The other thing I've been doing is, what I really like is, I went to the gym, and the main thing I like the gym for was doing some cardio exercise in one of their machines. Now, some people like running. I've never got on with running. I'm half Iranian, and I've got quite a stocky build with big fat calf muscles and thigh muscles. I think my legs are actually short for my height, and that's not uncommon in Iranian males. Think of those weightlifters, Iranian weightlifters who usually do well in the Olympics. Yeah, so I'm not a weightlifter build, but I'm of a fairly stocky type build, and I find running just a very unpleasant experience. I've never been able to get into it. So the bike, my bike, luckily I just had it done up back in the last winter, so in the last year, and my bike done up and serviced, because it's 10 years old, it's a great bike, but it was starting to fail in a number of ways, because it needed a sort of bit of a rebuild. So I spent a lot of money getting it redone. I'm so glad I did, because every few days I'll get on the bike, usually early in the morning when it's quiet, and I just go off for half an hour. There's quite a lot of hills around here, so it's a good workout. It's really quite taxing. It's a good cardio workout that I miss from the gym. But I have encountered some strange problems. So I try to, as far as possible, avoid like the canal towpath, which is near here. So the canal towpath is probably not even 2 meters wide. I would say 1.5 meters wide. I'm not sure. I've never measured it. But certainly if I was to lie down across it, I'm sure my feet would hang off one end of my head the other. It's not that wide. So it would be impossible to respect the 2 meter distance when you pass somebody. And of course, when you're cycling, if you're going at full pelt and somebody's running, you're belting out all this potentially virus-laden breath. So I thought, no, I've got to avoid the canal towpath and similar cycle paths that are small. But cycling along deserted suburban back streets, seems to be ideal. But the one problem I have encountered is that I find, this has happened several times, I keep encountering older folk in particular, like couples, out for their daily exercise, often in the morning, walking down the middle of the road rather than the pavements, so they don't have to get out of the way of people.
Yeah, and that means that
I then have to mount the pavement to get around them, which is backwards.
I never thought of that. I have to stop walking in the middle of the road. No, that's a good point. I also have a bike, and it's about 10 years old, actually. Yeah, I used to use it to ride to work, and maybe a bit more than 10 years old. It's a mountain bike, and I was just thinking I could really get that out. Again, needs a good clean, probably got punctures and stuff that need dealing with. But I don't know, do you, just on that, I had punctures in, because mountain bikes got big fat tires, well, they did back in those days anyway. And the way I used to cycle, I used to get punctures quite often because it was down a lane. There's a lane that runs from here down to the university I worked at, Heriot Watt, and there every year there would a tractor would come along and cut the hedges. And the hedges were all hawthorn, and it used a thing called a flail cutter, which it's just like a sort of a lawnmower on a stick sort of thing. But well, actually, it's not even as smart as that. I think it just whacks the hedge and knocks the bits of branch off. And what that does is all of the hawthorn pieces fall on the ground, and they're all like tank traps. They sit on because they're clusters of spines. They sit on like two or three spines, and one points upward. So it's guaranteed after the flail cutter had been through, and for months afterwards, you ride over it and then you get puncture. I used. Do you ever use that stuff that you can get? You used to be able to get. It's probably not available anymore. You put it through the valve, and it seals up the punctures. It's basically a gel with fibers in it that with a pumped up tire that's moving. The fibers block the holes in the inner tube, and you don't get it leaking. But if you leave it, then it leaks. The gunk eats the inside of the inner tube. Probably, I don't know.
I'll be honest, I've never had a puncture in my bike, and only once have I had a burst. It wasn't a puncture, it was the inner tube just failed, just because it was like 10 years old. Mm-hmm. That's why I took the bike in for its service, because it wasn't a puncture. I just took it to the bike shop, and the guy said, "This inner tube looks like it belongs in a museum." You know, so I've never had a puncture. I've ridden over glass. Mine's not a mountain bike, it's a cross bike. Which means it's sort of in between a road bike and a mountain bike. I don't know why. I've never had a puncture. Just been lucky, I guess. I have cycled over even broken glass, you know, because if somebody's broken glass on the road and if you're going at speed, you can't see it until it's too late. So even then, the shards haven't managed to get through the tyre. So
that's quite tough. That's been particularly unlucky with these little wooden tank traps down that lane.
Well, yeah, I've never faced that, so that's another thing. There's no hawthorn bushes around my way, so I've been spared that.
That would, you need to have them, or not as the case may be. But the plan is to get the bike out and maybe do a bit of cycling. I've got an interesting cycle path near me, the river that runs through Edinburgh called the Water of Leith originates in the hills not far away from my house. And so it runs down on its way to Edinburgh. And years ago, there was a railway line that ran alongside it. It ran from a town called, a little village really, called Balerno into central Edinburgh and back. It was a great commuter line. I think it was removed in the 1960s, and they turned that into a path. It's the most fantastic cycle way. It goes through tunnels and stuff. It's quite cool.
Well, that sounds good, yeah. I mean, there's actually around here, not many of the railways have been turned into cycle paths. So there are some when you get out the city that have, but where I am, the old railways have mainly been reopened again as railways.
Yeah.
You know, which is good. In fact, one of them hasn't, that goes through. I mean, Glasgow's got so many railway lines that were closed. I don't think people appreciate quite how much more extensive our railways used to be, but they have managed to reopen at least two big stretches Otherwise, they might have been turned into cycle paths. But I'd rather that there were railways, to be honest, because we could always cycle on the roads. I don't cycle on the roads because they're too busy. But yeah, I'd rather have the. I think the trains are more useful than cycleways to be in my book.
I do agree. Back in Norfolk, there's a brilliant cycle path that goes from Norwich, where I used to live, out into the wild somewhere or other. And I was walking it one time. It's lovely. It's all got trees over it, and it's really good. And it's an old railway line. And I discovered through a bit of digging into family history and stuff that it went past the little cottage out in the wilds where my grandmother used to live. And I found that her father had become a railway engineer. So the thinking is that these guys were building the railway back in the 1830s, 20s, something like that, whenever the railways would have been coming. And he sort of signed up with them and became a navvy. And then we never lived to see them take the railway up again, which would have been very, very unpleasant. But yeah, there's a lot of history to these old railway lines. It's one of the fascinating things about them, I think.
Yes, indeed. You know, I do appreciate the. I did spend many a weekend going around hunting down what you could see of these bits of industrial archaeology around Glasgow, of which where I used to live, which is a bit further, which actually wasn't. I don't live in Glasgow. I live just outside Glasgow. Where I used to live, it was just full of this stuff. And you'd see this like abandoned bit of waste ground or something. Well, it didn't look like waste ground now. It looks like trees, but it was waste ground when I was little, when I grew up nearby. And now you look at it, it looks like a nice wood. In fact, you'll see deer prancing about if you look closely. But they're old railway sidings and stuff like that. Quite large tracts of land. No doubt houses will appear in them soon.
Yeah. Well, that's what's happened here. When I moved here originally, there was by the Water of Lee, there was an old factory sort of thing, and it was actually a paper mill. It was long closed down and being used by small businesses. It's now all houses have been raised to the ground. But there was a water mill that drove the paper water, wheel that drove the paper mill. So I've been looking at local history, there's pictures of the railway bringing esparto grass to the paper mill to make paper, whatever esparto grass is, you make paper with it, apparently. Without hopefully not boring everybody to death, along the Water of Leith, there's quite a lot of industrial archaeology of the same sort, but obviously Edinburgh's nowhere near as big as Glasgow and has less. But as the thing about the Water of Leith was, it was used to power all sorts of mills, flour mills and stuff. But snuff mills were very, very popular. There's several places along the way where it shows the such and such snuff mill was sited. that's a whole different world. Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, and it's the same is true, of course, in Glasgow along the. Not the Clyde, the big river in Glasgow is called the Clyde, but more along the Kelvin, which I live near. In fact, it was exactly what you described. There was paper mills, flint mills, stuff mills. And actually, just in case there's any fellow scientists out there, if Kelvin sounds familiar, it's named, it indirectly named the unit of temperature, the Kelvin, which is used in physics. Because William Thomson, who was a physicist at Glasgow University, took the title Lord Kelvin after the river that ran past Glasgow University. That's the connection. So the River Kelvin gave its name to that the temperature scale that's used in physics.
That is very cool. Yes. Yeah. There's all those sorts of historical aspects of Glasgow are fascinating. I don't know anything near enough.
No, I could. That's maybe one thing I could spend more time gawping at all these. Well, I do spend a lot of time gawping at pictures of Glasgow. That's just this very week I saw somebody post online a picture of a disused swimming pool. I thought, oh, right, some disused swimming pool. I went, oh, hang on, that address, that's right next to university. Oh, it must have been knocked down like 50 years ago. And to my astonishment, the building is not knocked down. It's still there. And I walk past all the time and I have no idea there's a swimming pool inside it. Wow. You know, I looked at the picture. I know that building. I did not know there was a... Anyway, I mean, when I say swimming pool, it's lain dry now for 20 years and the roof's come off. It's a terrible state. But it's a very old-fashioned type of Victorian type swimming baths, they would have called them then. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's quite a rare building to still be standing, you know, but I look at the pictures, it's too far gone. But it's the kind of thing that I walk past all the time. Well, I used to walk past before the lockdown all the time, and I have no idea what was inside that building at all.
Yeah, that sort of stuff is fascinating. My son and his girlfriend used to have a flat in towards the centre of Edinburgh, in an area called Morningside. And they used to go swimming to a place not far. I can't quite think where it is in relation, but it is one of those Victorian baths. It's a building, a Victorian building made in red sandstone and stuff. And it's got one of the old-fashioned style baths there. I think people used to go there for a wash and stuff, not in the pool per se, but I don't know enough about the history of these things, but they were quite common at one time. And this one still exists anyway.
Yeah, no, I think in the time before, you might have hot water, maybe even running cold water, in tenements in Glasgow. Like tenements meaning tall apartment type blocks. This would be where you got washed. And mm-hmm. attached to it in Glasgow, there was a thing called the steamy, which...
Yes.
Yeah, where you would with a woman at the time would wash the clothes, and there's an expression in Glasgow called the talk of the steamy, which means the gossip. You know, you get your local news by all the gossiping housewives still at the steamy attached to the baths.
I've heard of this. I don't know if that was an Edinburgh thing at all, but certainly been mentioned since I've lived in Scotland. So yeah, that's really cool.
So how have you been entertaining yourself in the last few weeks?
Well, projects and stuff. I like to write up things for Hyperbolic Radio, so I've been trying to increase my production rate with HBR shows because I've got a bit more time and the inclination and stuff like that. I've slowed down in recent years, I have to say. There was a time when I would do like one a month or something, but it's I'm not doing quite that rate. But you know, there's things. Just uploaded one yesterday, which suddenly was a thing that sprang into my mind, and I managed to do it did it the first day and uploaded it the second. So I've been doing that. I'm also into electronics a bit, trying to learn my way around all these fantastic little devices. There's a thing called the ESP8266. Which is costs about £2 or £3. It has the power of an Arduino and Wi-Fi, and not that particular one, but its bigger brother, the ESP32, has got Bluetooth as well. So you can, and people are putting it inside all manner of Internet of Things devices. So you can build your own stuff, or you can buy things and subvert them to your own needs and stuff. And it's really, really quite exciting. It's available there. I'm way behind the curve with this stuff. People have been doing this now for 3 or 4 years, possibly, but it's still fascinating.
Yes, I remember you introducing me to this device, I think, at Odd Camp last year.
Yes, that's right. The guy from Edinburgh Linux User Group, whose name is Chris.
Chris, where the hat.
Yeah.
I remember he had a hat.
That's right, Chris with the hat. Who's... Yeah, he had several in his pocket, and he was saying, have you used these things? These are amazing.
Well, that's proper geeky, having several in your pocket, just in the off chance it might come in useful, you know. I always think you can remake a modern version of the A-Team, where all these geeks and nerds disappear into the garage and they build this thing out of Arduinos and bits and pieces that defeats the bad guy.
Yeah. These things are amazingly powerful. When you consider the people have been using Arduinos for a long time, but they're not all that cheap. You know, you can get knock-off clones of some of the low-end Arduinos for a few pounds, but the genuine ones are still moderately expensive for sort of kids or people without a lot of budget. And but these things these ESP devices are very, very good value for money. They're all out of China, of course, but there's actually, probably told you this at some point, there's a whole range of IoT type switches and controllers and things that you can buy from a Chinese company called Sonoff, S-O-N-O-F-F, and they contain these devices, and there's been a huge movement to strip them down, put better software in, because, you know, the manufacturers want to lock you into using their servers, so all the data goes through their servers, etc. But you can easily turn it into an IoT device that you control and stuff. So I'm amazed how much this stuff has been going on over the years, and I've not really noticed it.
No, I haven't. I mean, I've got an Arduino. I played with it a little tiny bit, but I don't know. Just life just seems to fill, my time seems to fill up with other things, and it always ends up going to the back of my list of things to do.
They tend to be things that require quite a lot of time to work through, don't they? I mean, it's because you're writing stuff at quite a low level if you want to get really into it, and you also need to do the electronics of it. So you need to dedicate a fair bit of time to it as you're starting up, at least.
Yeah. That's essentially it. But also, I know my character that when I was younger, I would just, you know, you start fiddling with a bit of code or something, and then 3 days later, the sun it would rise, and you think, oh, I thought it was the evening, you know. You know, but now I can't do that, you know, especially life is not as it was when I was younger. But I have, I thought I would have a lot of time to do these kind of things when this lockdown started, although I quickly thought, no, hang on a minute, my wife's going to be working from home, so I'll be denied my study Monday to Friday during the day. Although I'm actually in my study today because my wife's not working, taking Fridays off at the moment. And my kids are at home from school, and the younger one, she'll need my attention, and the older one, well, yeah, he's supposed to be doing exams, but his exams are cancelled. I'm not really thinking thinking I can get them to do anything at all. So I spend a lot of time trying to get them to do stuff, and it's not been too bad actually, but it does eat up a lot of my time. You know, I really have to be around, at least to just keep an eye on them as much as anything else, to make sure they're actually doing it rather than necessarily being hands-on helping the whole time. So it's been fine, but I very quickly learned to recalibrate my expectations of free time and free space because I've lost my study essentially. I thought early on, look, if I have it, if my expectations are I'll be playing with all my little gadgets and getting my old BBC Micro that I acquired last year that we talked about before, if I started spending time wanting to do my little projects and fixing my old Amigas, whatever, I'll very quickly become frustrated because they're all things where I need to get my full concentration, get soldering iron, know what you have to be set up, got it up to temperature, get everything laid out, and get in the zone, you know, tracing around the circuit boards, do the fixing, and then a child comes in and wants you to do something. And I hate having my concentration broken. I find it very difficult to get back into it again. I have a very even temper, but I do not like being disturbed when I'm in the middle of full concentration. And the last thing anyone needs is a grumpy person in the house. So I decided to relax all my expectations of what I could get done and just try and enjoy my time doing what I could do rather than having expectations of doing all these things and then becoming a bit grumpy arse.
I do know the situation. I find the days are a lot shorter than I think they're going to be. So, you know, you start off on doing something and get distracted, and then, oh, it's time for time for dinner, and soon it's time to sleep. Let's all the time go on. It's difficult.
But one, I'll tell you one highlight, and it's Hacker Public Radio I have to thank for this, is the Dungeons and Dragons session, which for me are Wednesday evening at 5:30 with Klaatu. It was his instigation, so I thank him for that. And also Ken Fallon's son and CRVS and myself, the three players in that session. And that's just tremendous fun. It really works well over with audio only. I've only ever played Dungeons and Dragons in person before, and even then it's been fairly difficult because none of us are regular players, and if Dungeon Master isn't particularly experienced, whereas Klaatu knows his stuff, which is great. And also I should say that for him, he's in New Zealand, so it's 4:30 a.m. for him when we start.
Wow.
I know, but as I think as he said to Ken one time when Ken tried to rearrange the time because he felt bad for Klaatu, Klaatu went, no, this is how I like to start my day. Why not?
Wow, that's amazing. That really is amazing. That's dedication, isn't it? Really?
Yeah. And it's not just one. He does it. I think he offered two time slots, Wednesdays and Thursdays, and he got enough takers for both, so he ran both. So I'm only present at one of these two. I think the one on Thursday is running. I haven't heard anything from that, but it's just tremendous fun, I have to say. I don't know if you fancy it, Dave. I don't know if you can be a late addition to our party. You'd certainly be welcome, as far as I'm concerned.
That's a nice thought. I'm not really. I don't know. I don't have the mind for that sort of thing. It's not that I'm antisocial or anything. I'm just not very sociable in the sense of being particularly good at being social, I guess. Oh, did you hear that noise, by the way?
I did, yes.
You know what that is?
What is that? No.
It's a fish fan.
Oh, a fish fan.
The Edinburgh fish
fan. Right. Sounds like an ice cream fan.
I wonder if he's come from Pitt and Ween. I wouldn't be surprised, it could be his brother.
My one doesn't have it. That's only like a sort of fairly nice tone. My one just toots his horn several times.
Okay. He's got some sort of fancier horn, air horn or something on his van. But it's a popular thing, actually. He didn't come past my house. Maybe there's not many fishy people around this way. I must run after him one time and see if I could grab something off him.
So, that's what you do. I mean, if like one of mine, because the fish van doesn't stop outside my house, it goes around the corner. And I just go around the corner, but there's an older guy who's two doors up, and he's a bit slower now, and obviously doesn't want to leave the end of his driveway in the current conditions. Mm-hmm. So the fish van actually nicely stops right outside his house at the end of his driveway just for him, which is nice.
Very good. Yeah. It's cool. That particular van, I think, has been going around this particular estate for maybe as long as I've been here, which is 30 plus years. So and I've never partaken. So that's you prompted me to get a bit of fish from your tea one time.
I mean my fish fan also has vegetables and cakes and eggs and biscuits and and that most prized of things recently, flour, so you could bake with. They had actually had flour, because it's like toilet roll and flour. The problem, the shortages of those two items, the more I've understood it, I've realised it's nothing to do with panic buying. It's maybe slightly elevated levels of people buying, but it's not panic buying. What it is, I've discovered, in both those items, is there's two ways of delivering these items. One is through, especially toilet roll, one is through the shops where you would buy it for a household, and the other, of course, is through places of work. So, like, if you work somewhere, they'll have toilet, and they'll have toilet roll. So there's that whole supply chain, and the problem is that suddenly everyone worked from home, and that meant, of course, households were consuming a lot more toilet roll at home than they were at work, because kids would have been at school, parents might have been out of work, all that kind of thing. And now they're all at home. That put that shifted the demand from the wholesale side of the toilet roll market to the supermarket shelf. And it took a while for that to adapt. So it wasn't. Well, it was slightly elevated.
I think there was a bit of panic buying, wasn't there? People following one another and, why has that guy got so much toilet roll? I need to do the same.
That
sort of thing. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely the videos. I mean, there was definitely some fights broke out in supermarkets. Definitely. But But that was a minority of it. You know, I think most people were just thinking, right, well, we, you know, better stock up a little bit, or, you know, or just, well, we're using up faster. Now we're all locked in the home and can't get out.
No, it makes sense. I suppose there's an opening there for somebody to buy the office supplies and then produce it, have a 3D printed device where they can sort of wind a domestic size roll off, multiple domestic size pieces off it or something, and sell them or use them or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, thing with the handle and gears and a guillotine that you stamp on it and then it cuts the wood. You know, there's an opening there for somebody.
Definitely, yes. I have lots of ingenious solutions, I'm sure. Yeah, so that's one thing I've, not Toilet Roll, but the Dungeons and Dragons. The other thing I've been doing is, because we've had this amazing weather the last week, sunny days. In fact, it hasn't rained for a week now, I think, which in Glasgow is just unheard of at any time of the year. Yeah, it's been sunny. It's 20 degrees today, which is really quite unusual for April. But what I've been doing is spending a lot of time when the kids don't need me, but so I'm available. I've got a small balcony at the front of my house. I sit in that in the sunshine and read a book. And the book I'm reading is Dracula by Bram Stoker, which I've always wanted to read but never have.
Very good. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I'm loving it. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I have to say that there is something, like, in this unpleasant virus situation that we're in, I think before I started reading it, I was following the news, and then it came a point where and some stuff on social media, and then it was just all becoming very frustrating. I think a lot of false reporting of stuff, and people that I knew and liked, and some people that I would have thought would know better sharing stuff that was turned out to be bogus. So that was really frustrating me. So somehow switching to read Dracula was a good way of escaping that.
Yeah.
So bloodthirsty vampires was my way of escaping all of that.
Well, yeah, but it's a valid thing to do, I think. It's a fascinating book. I've read it years and years ago and reread it in the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years or something, just because, you know, when you read books when you're younger, you maybe get an impression that then gets mangled by your brain over time. Yeah. And then you go and read it again. Wow, I never realized it was like this. And that's what I did, and it was great. It's a very strange book. I'd love to know more about where the ideas for it came from. Presumably there are some sort of folklore associations with it, but I've never really come across much.
Yes, I think the stories do come out of Eastern Europe, which is why Transylvania is where it starts off. And there's two reasons why I ended up reading it. The first is, last 3 years, in fact, we've gone and spent New Year with my sister's family in a little seaside village called Whitby, where Dracula is, in fact, that's where he lands in the book. That's when he arrives on these shores. It's literally, he gets washed up on into Whitby. And the other nice little piece of history, then it is explicitly mentioned in the book, is that if you sit and Whitby is strange because it's the seaside, but it's a little bit of the English coast. It doesn't run north-south, because most of England and Scotland roughly runs north-south, but there's a kink there. So Whitby sits in a bit of coast that actually faces north. And there's a river, the River Esk, I think, splits the town in half. So apparently Bram Stoker was sat facing east, looking across it's like a bit of a valley down to the estuary of the River Esk. And another half of the town's on the other side. And the other side of the river, there's this great old church called St. Mary's, and it has two windows, and the two windows were reflecting the setting sun, which was red. And so it gave the impression of two eyes, and that is where the Dracula's two red eyes comes from.
Wow. Well,
and there's actually a bench that's on, which is said to be the one or not the bench, but a bench is in the exact location of the one that Bram Stoker was said to have sat on when he saw this. So yeah, I thought that was, and then in the book, that very, it's almost explicitly mentioned at one point, you know, that one of the characters has seen this, has seen this reflection in these church windows. So yeah, so there was lots of connections, a lot of local connections with Whitby in particular that I could make. The other reason that I was interested in it is that after I was spent the last New Year in Whitby, came back home, and then BBC had a dramatisation of Dracula in three parts, which was, I thought was very good, although only the first part was faithful to the book. The second and third part was interesting, but not, I think, as good as the first part.
Yeah. No, it's good. I told you, I think, that my daughter had been out to Transylvania a few years ago. I don't know how many years it is. Between school and university, she took a year out, and she got a volunteer place out working in Romania, and ended up in Brasov, which is in Transylvania. And they went to what is supposed to be Dracula's castle. Some of the volunteers went there for a weekend trip. But it was, she's not really into the Dracula thing, but she said there was hardly anything there. The Romanians have not really made much of the whole Dracula thing. Imagine if it was in other countries, you wouldn't be able to move for the Dracula thing. There's hardly anything there. She was looking to buy some, couldn't find any.
Certainly Whitby is absolutely stuffed with Dracula-related stuff. And to be honest, it actually even gets a bit tacky in places, the Dracula experience and stuff like that. But it's a very atmospheric little town, so it's certainly worth visiting. In fact, at certain times of the year, maybe usually at this time of the year, perhaps, I'm not sure exactly when it is, but Goths, as in, like, I say young folk, but it might not just be young folk, but people who dress in black that like Goth-type music, they descend upon the town, and then you get people who come to see the Goths. So it's certainly developed into quite a nice tourist earner. Gotham. In normal times for Whitby.
Wow, that's quite good. I've never been to Whitby. I've not really been that part of Yorkshire at all. Into York and around that sort of thing. And I lived in Lancashire for many years, but yeah, you know, if you live in Lancashire, you don't go to York much, Yorkshire not very much. No, that's not true, but there's all these sorts of, oh, you're from Lancashire, oh, I don't want to talk to you. it's not true, it's a joke. I must put that on my list of places to visit sometime.
Yeah, certainly recommend it.
Yeah, sounds good. So,
well,
you were going to say what I'm just about to say, probably is nearly an hour we've been talking.
Yes, indeed, and I'm thinking that I've left my daughter for, I think my wife has gone out while we've been talking, and now I'm nominally supposed to go and look. I think she's finished her school day, but I'm conscious that there's lots of crisps and chocolate in the kitchen that's within her reach. Just as a wee postscript, I've discovered that there is no place, even if I stand on my toes and put the crisps and chocolate, my daughter, who's, well, when she's eight, so she's not that, you know, she doesn't come up to my shoulders yet, she finds a way of getting it. I don't even know how she does it sometimes. I assume she must climb up there or something.
You've got a ladder somewhere in the house, or you don't know that. Yes. Yeah. All right. It's a nightmare. And you don't want to be getting into locking cupboards up and that sort of thing, do you?
No. I mean, to be fair to her, she only really does it to wind me up. You know, she doesn't do it out of greed. You know, it's not greedy, but really just because she lets herself be caught. You know, or lets me see that she's got it. Just because, you know, then I'm incredulous. Like, how did you get that? You know, I suspect her brother, because her brother's now taller than me, so her brother could be getting it for her, but he's inclined to do nothing that would help his little sister, or vice versa. That's what I doubted.
Yes, I know those family dynamics. It's yes, my daughter's due to turn 25 on Sunday, but the brother sister dynamics are still there in different forms, so even at that age.
Yeah. Oh, well, I can believe
it's all good.
Yeah. Well, it was lovely talking to you, Dave, and maybe we could do this again and see how things develop in coming weeks.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's nice to have a chat. We missed. I think Mumble to do it is a good way forward. So and we get to record things and share. So that's good. Yeah. Thanks, Andrew, for the suggestion.
Yeah, that was good. And well, stay safe, and everyone who's listening, stay safe. And hopefully, we'll see some light at the end of the tunnel at some point.
Yep. Same message from me. Okay then.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.